3:45 p.m. The date is Monday, April 4th, 2005. We don't have a quorum yet, but members are en route. We do have Representative Roper here and myself, Chairman Anderson, and I know Representative Guttenberg and Cott and Crawford are en route. So I will notice their attendance as they come in. We have three bills today. I was intending to hear briefly House Bill 180 and then get to the other bills, but because we pulled House Bill 227, Alaska Small Loans Act, from today's calendar, we will hear House Bill 192, then Senate Bill 25. Those should be fairly brief, and then we'll get to House Bill 180 and continue the analysis until a little before 5, and then I'd like to adjourn because of our majority caucus. With that being said, we'll have House Bill 192, and looks like Senators Elton and Stevens. And that bill, state your name, affiliation for the record, and go ahead and present the bill. And Representative Crawford's here.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Chuck Harlemert. I'm with the Alaska Department of Revenue. I'm pleased to present House Bill 192 to you today. The bill seeks to make the licensing requirements for fisheries business tax more representative of, or more responsive to taxpayer needs. To improve the protections for employees and fishermen, and to require more accountability from processors to cover the obligations that they pay to support the industry. Section 1 of the bill simply adds to the existing requirement to pay all taxes due under Title 43, the additional obligations to pay the seafood marketing assessment, contributions for employment security tax, OSHA fines, and local fisheries taxes. Section 2 of the bill is a fairly minor provision that allows the department to allow taxpayers to use the same security for two separate tax years during the bridge period between the end of their one taxable year and the due date for payment of tax for that year. In the subsequent year.
Okay. I'm going to interrupt here. We have Representative Guttenberg as well, so we do have our quorum. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Section 3 is the most complex, certainly on the surface part of the bill. And what it attempts to do is make the bonding requirements, what we call the labor bond, more responsive to risks that are evidenced by taxpayer behavior. Under current law, each processor and each primary fish buyer is required to present us with a $10,000 security bond. That bond can be increased to $50,000 or $100,000 under certain conditions. We found those conditions to be not responsive enough, and the bill basically introduces more responsiveness. And it also reduces the administrative burden for Department of Labor to attach the bond for the payment of unpaid employment security taxes. In addition, a recent amendment was to add tenders in as bond beneficiaries. And with that, I'll respond to questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions, Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, it's been my experience when dealing with types of bonds and surety bonds, to try to check on the availability in the marketplace through the chair. Has the department made any inquiries of the industry, underwriting industry, whether they will write bonds for these amounts and under the conditions that are set forth in the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, yes, we have. Before we drafted the bill, we surveyed. There were 12 providers operating in the state, 12 bond providers operating in the state, according to our records. We were able to talk to 11 of them. And, you know, essentially, bonds are an extension of credit. And there is very little trouble obtaining a $10,000 bond. Of course, in any case, when the bond level is increased, the consequences are more dramatic. It's typically bond providers will not simply pony up the increased bond amount without security, usually in the form of cash. So in effect, what's going to happen in an increased bond under current law and this bill is that when a bond is increased, the taxpayer is going to have to come up with cash for the increased amount.
President Roper, follow
Mr. Chairman, I would just to clarify, I haven't had a chance to review this in sufficient order. Is the are we raising the initial bond amount on all processors now, or
Through the chair, Representative Roper, no, we are not. There is no change to existing processors in the basic bond level, or the right to use real property in lieu of bond. The changes are is that the bonds will the requirement for a bond increase is easier under current law, under the bill, I'm sorry. And the right to use real property in lieu of a bond is restricted to those processors who don't have a record of failing to pay fishermen or employees or tenders.
If there is some history of failure to perform, is that when the bonds are increased or what?
Through the chair, Representative Rokeberg, two things happen when you have a if you have a judgment from a fisherman, an employee, or a tender in excess of $10,000, your bond will be increased from the basic $10,000 level to $50,000 level under this bill. The only difference between that law and current law is the inclusion of tenders, one, and under this bill, the mere existence of that judgment triggers the increase. Under current law, if the processor pays that judgment on the side and doesn't allow the bond to be used to pay it, it cannot affect his bond by law. That is one of the reasons why we believe that current law is not responsive enough to taxpayer behavior.
So, Mr. Chairman, the practice is typically if the licensee satisfies the judgment, then they don't have to pay the increased bonding amount. Is that how it works currently?
Through the chair, Representative Rokeberg, that's exactly how it works. If they pay it directly under current law, they escape the consequence of having their bond level increase. Yes.
And how widespread is this practice? Usually we have, usually the biggest problem is if there's a major default or insolvency or bankruptcy or something when they can't provide any payment or? Here we're looking at trying to look at a pattern of conduct and not, I guess, is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Roberg, I think you hit it right on the head. Under current law, they do simply pay it directly, escape the consequence. There's no limit on the amount of times that can happen, and it does happen. I believe that there's only one taxpayer I'm aware of who has a bond requirement over the $10,000 level at this point, and they're not licensed. So we know we have more than one processor that imposes a risk on employees and fishermen, but the current law is not very responsive.
And is the surety bond for failure to make wage payments, is that included? Or
through the chair, Representative Rokeberg, under current law, the surety bond goes to pay unpaid wages, to pay fishermen for unpaid fish, and unpaid employment security contributions. Under current law, those same three beneficiaries exist, and we add another one for tender operators.
Mr. Chairman, so the limit's just going to remain at $10,000? I mean, I don't want to be anybody to add additional burden to our beleaguered fishing industry, but that seems like a pretty low amount.
Through the chair, Representative Rokeberg, we did not want to punish the majority of processors who do not cause trouble and are responsible for the behavior of a few. And I guess I will note that in doing this, we did survey all other states that have a significant amount of fishing and fish processing activity and found that we were already the most protective. We had the highest bond requirement of all their states.
Well, just the conclusion, Mr. Chairman. We had this very unfortunate circumstance with the Woodbine Fish Company. Had they had any kind of a negative track record with a higher bond, or would they have been covered by this new bill?
Through the chair, Representative Rokeberg, in I'm a little uncertain about how much I can disclose about individual taxpayers, but this bill would have made a substantial difference in the amount of funds available to protect employees and fishermen in that case, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Seeing none at this time, we'll go next to, looks like Department of Law is just here for questions, so if you have legal questions, they can answer. As you note to me, and I'll have them come up, Chris come up, but otherwise we have Gray Mitchell, then Pat Shire, Department of Labor.
Hello, Gray Mitchell, Director of Labor Standards and Safety at Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And I'm here to just discuss our support of the bill. I think that Mr. Harlemer covered the basics, so I'll just open myself up to questions if anyone has any from labor's perspective.
Is there any question of Mr. Mitchell? Representative Guttenberg?
Just to give us an idea, who is there to testify? And
looks like Pat Shire is the last one, Department of Labor also. Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, I could repeat the question regarding, are there surety bonds or bonds such as this required in under other licensures and other industry groups to protect wage obligations? Is this a common or uncommon type of a circumstance?
Through the chair, Representative Roekberg, there are a couple of other areas. Contractors are one that have a bond level that can be used to satisfy the costs associated with labor. That's the only one that I know of off the top of my head.
Is that the specialty contractor one?
Through the chair, that's general and specialty.
Representative who? No?
Yeah.
There you go. Representative Cutler?
Thank you. Following up on Representative Roper, is the... If they shut that door, is that okay? The process is such a unique group that this is a specific problem to them, are you adding them to other groups like contractors. So... over my years, I've always heard of problems like this with processes, but I didn't know if it was just being publicized at a higher level. So are they being singled out, or are they just being added because of a history? Of course, there's always good ones and bad ones, and we don't want to penalize the good ones, but we want to make sure that the ones that are in violation come under this. But has this been a problem for this industry historically?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I think it was really a big problem last year. We had two or three larger processors have some significant problems paying not only fishermen but employees and suppliers and everybody associated with them. And I think those are what caused the need to take a look at, the bond requirements and the licensing requirements for fish processing companies, and to raise the bar a little bit so that a company, needs to kind of show that they're a good player in order to get a processor bond and a processor license.
I just think Representative Roper, there's some questions I'm looking for to surgically find out exactly what's going on here that I can't find the words for.
That's never bothered me.
Yeah.
Okay, Pat, you want to take a shot? Thanks, Gray.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Shire, Acting Deputy Director of the Employment Security Division of Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Also chief of the unemployment insurance tax, and I'm here to testify in support of this bill. The two principal issues are clearing the unpaid taxes prior to licensure for the current year so that we don't end up in a situation with workers and fish sitting on the dock too late to do anything about it. Also, it compresses the time frame for the Employment Security Division to move against the bond for satisfaction of employment security taxes for the benefit of other employers that are paying their fair share into the trust fund. And with that, I'll entertain any questions.
I was going to ask a question. I see Jerry in the back. Do United Fishermen, are they going to testify? No, not on this one. Have you heard any objections to the legislation? I hate to always ask that on the record, but I haven't.
Mr. Chairman, no, I haven't. Yeah.
Are there any questions for Pat? No?
Thank you.
Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, the same question occurred to me. I just looked through the file. I don't see any testimony or letters or anything from any people other than the news article about the exchange student at the Woodbine situation in Igigig. Or anybody supporting or opposing the bill? It's a little bit lean in that regard.
Sure. It sounds like from the revenue and from labor, they endorse it and support it and have been working on the drafting of it, but I'm not sure. I would assume with Jerry and others here that if they had a problem, they'd testify, I hope. It's already passed out of, what was the other committee of referral?
Fisheries.
Right. And that's the sponsor
chairman,
of the
legislation. The co-chairman of Fisheries, did you have any other outside testimony, Representative Ledoux, or?
I'm not sure we had, I can't remember whether we had outside testimony. This bill, I think, is kind of based on a couple of incidents which have happened, and they have really, really been bad incidents. And I think most of us on the Fisheries Committee were pretty supportive of this bill because of those incidents, which have really impacted many of our communities.
And the legislation does move on to finance to look at some of the fiscal impacts. Well, I'm going to close the public hearing portion. Folks from the administration are here to answer questions. I don't see any questions. So unless you have a compelling reason to hold the bill, I say we move it on. And I don't have any pressing questions for my review of it. If no one has any other comments, I'll take a motion to move the bill on to finance. Representative Ledoux?
I'll move CS for House Bill 192 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing and hearing no objections, so moved. Thanks for attending. We'll go next to Senate Bill 25, Genetically Modified Fish. And we have the Honorable Senator Elton here. Please rise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you ready, Mr. Chair?
You bet.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill at this point in the session. I really appreciate it. I'm presenting not just on my behalf, but on behalf of the other co-prime sponsor, Senator Gary Stevens of Kodiak. And the bill is very straightforward. I'm not going to take too much of your time. I'll begin by just briefly outlining a conversation I had immediately preceding my way to the podium here with a member of UFA who said that he is sorry that their letter of support is not in your packet, and he wanted to convey to me that UFA does support the bill.
Okay.
With that, Mr. Chair, the bill is picked up a nickname. It's called the Frankenfish Bill. It is actually a work product of the Joint Legislative Salmon Industry Task Force of a couple of years ago. That task force had members of the House, members of the Senate, members of the processing industry, and members of the harvesting industry that focused on challenges facing the Alaska salmon industry. Genetically modified fish are defined as those fish whose genetic structure has been altered at the molecular level by means not naturally possible. And right now at the retail level, only one product, one genetically modified fish product is available. It's a glow-in-the-dark aquarium fish, but pending is an application before the Food and Drug Administration for genetically modified farm fish. It would be an Atlantic salmon. It is also expected that catfish, tilapia, and others will follow close behind, including several of the other salmon species. In addition, a U.S.-Canadian firm wants to produce genetically modified Atlantic salmon for human consumption in Nova Scotia. Their plan is not just to produce genetically modified Atlantic fish, but also to sell the eggs to other farmed fish purveyors around the world. Regardless of pending decisions by regulators in the U.S. or Canada, it's not reasonable also to expect that other jurisdictions will not move to genetically modified fish. The big advantage, of course, being that the genetically modified fish is usually modified so that they have very fast grow-out times. They can produce a fish of a certain size in about half the time as it would take to produce a fish that is not genetically modified. Alaskans, this bill is nothing more, we can't do more, than just a simple consumer notification. It provides that if genetically modified fish or shellfish are sold in Alaska, that it needs to be identified on the label at retail. Included in your packets are information that speaks to some of the human consumption concerns, some of the environmental concerns. I will just say that the argument that has been made by the genetically modified food industry is that, you know, for a long time they've been producing genetically modified soybeans. The significant difference, of course, being that a soybean does not just get up and swim away if, in fact, there are breaches in the farm. And we know that the question with farm fish isn't will they escape, but when and how many will escape. And millions have escaped to this point, and it's anticipated will continue to escape from pens. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll quit the monologue part of this, and if there are any questions, I'll eagerly engage in the dialogue component of the hearing.
We brought security here because we think this will be a highly debated bill. Representative Roper, Crawford.
I had a chance to really go through this, but do you have a section here that asks the Coast Guard or Navy to put a naval blockade in Prince Rupert if they import these or something? I had some experience with that in the past about the Marine Highway.
Through the chair, I'm tempted to say that I seriously considered it, but did not want a referral to the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee. But I did not consider it, and I think this is a difficult situation for Alaska. I mean, all we can do in this arena is provide for consumer notification, and try to, in our boundaries, try to draw a very bright line between industrially produced fish and wild and natural fish. I think it would create a playground for attorneys if we tried to go in the direction that Representative Roepberg has suggested.
Any other questions? Seeing and hearing.
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Let's see. The biotech industry organization talks about the courts have struck down this mandatory labeling. Have you had any response to that?
And it will be a relatively, I guess, more of an overview answer to a fairly specific question. There are, at the federal level right now, there is an awful lot of debate about the application of regulations on labeling protein. Whether it's fish or beef, and what kind of processed protein products must be labeled. So that's a very brief answer to what's happening at the congressional and the federal bureaucratic level. But there have been no problems at all with consumer notification on labels at the state level. And in fact, here in the state of Alaska, we require that farmed fish be labeled as farmed fish if sold at retail, and now if sold at the food service level in restaurants, that it's required to be labeled on the menu.
Okay, good. Well, next we have, it's great for him to come down, is John Twomley. I hope I pronounced his name right. Yeah, you bet. You want to come up? You can state your name again so it's recorded. It's polite of you to pull off your hat. And what school you go to?
Oh, hello. My name is John Twomley, And I'm an 8th grade student currently attending at Don Zagahini Middle School. And I'm also a 14-year resident of Chino, Alaska. I'd like to thank you, Senators, for taking the time out of your day to listen to me give my opinion on SB 25. I'm here to speak in support of SB 25, an act relating to the labeling and identification of genetically modified fish and fish products. And I think this is a good idea and should be passed for the following reasons. First of all, I'd like to tell you what exactly a genetically modified GM fish is. It is a finfish or shellfish whose genetic structure has been altered at the molecular level by means that are not possible under natural conditions, unlike wild salmon. One reason that I support Senator Elton's bill is because, as he says, there is a worldwide concern regarding the unknown effects of genetically modified seafood on humans and on the health of our environment. Due to the effects being unknown, the consumers could be physically at risk, and since the products are not labeled as genetically modified, people wishing to avoid this risk will be unable to do so. The passing of this bill will provide awareness to the consumer. GM seafood not only affects our bodies, but our Alaskan economy as well. If GM fish are introduced into Alaskan waters, they could transmit diseases to wild salmon, which would then affect the livelihood of our Alaskan commercial fishermen. Furthermore, if a GM fish is caught by someone, she or he will have no way to tell if it is a GM fish unless it was tagged or had a distinctive mark, which would allow a person to tell the difference between a wild salmon and a GM salmon. In addition to the risk of disease from escaped GM salmon, there is also a risk that GM fish will breed and destroy the habitat of wild salmon by consuming the nutrients necessary for the wild salmon to survive. Considering the downsides to GM fish, they should be prohibited. However, short of prohibition, consumers should be warned. Therefore, I urge you to vote for SB 25. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Boy, you really did a lot of research on that. I'm impressed. Mm-hmm. Are there any questions for John? Representative Roferick.
Mr. Chairman, John, what's your favorite fish to eat?
King salmon.
Oh, mine too. That's Chilcot. Southeast King salmon. Yeah.
Not
we don't want to have those genetically modified. They're doing just fine, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for coming.
Okay.
Can you tell us anything, John, about genetically modified humans like Representative Lynn, who wasn't able to attend?
No, right here. He's gone.
Yeah, he's not here.
By the way, here's an Alaska pin here.
There you go.
Speak up, Representative
Thanks,
Lynn.
Buddy.
Well, John, I tell you, he was as compelling as Senator Elton, I tell you, with this. No, that was a good partnership there presenting the bill. I don't suppose there are any other questions, or you would have asked Senator Elton. So if I could have a motion, I'll close the public hearing, and a motion to move the bill out of committee. There we go. Representative Crawford, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to move SB 25 with individual recommendations and
zero fiscal notes.
Zero fiscal.
Hearing no objection, the bill moves on. Good job, John. Okay, well, we have about 30 minutes, I would say, a little bit more. Why don't we have Paul come up? And we'll keep going through workers' comp, going through the sections, and then we'll adjourn and go on with our lives. And we'll take a brief adieu till he's ready. Take your time. I think he's here to go through, continue going through.
That's why I figured I might as well.
The bill, which I intend to have completed within the next two meetings, and I think we can get through everything. We have section 2 on the first page of your analysis that you were going to go through next, and if you could go ahead and do that.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul F. Lasanke. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation within the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Picking up where the chairman just indicated, Section 2 of the bill is a change to protect the benefit payments from an insurer's insolvency by requiring in-state deposits to back the insurer's loss reserves. Now, I'm not the expert that Director Hall is, and I believe she may be online if there are any specific questions about how this section would function. but it's designed to have actual assets deposited in state so that if we have another untoward incident like we did with Fremont, for example, where we did have to come to the legislature last session and ask for a special fix to bail out the Guarantee Association, that there would, in any future insolvency, be these deposits in state that would be available and would be keyed to the next section, which is Section 3, which talks that those deposits would be releasable by the director of the Division of Insurance to the Alaska Insurance Guarantee Association, the group that actually pays the benefits to injured workers whose employers' insurers have gone under.
And pardon me, Paul. Hey, Don, we passed out the workers' comp bill just now, so we're on the death penalty bill.
And so Sections 2 and 3, Section 2 establishes the assets, and Section 3 establishes a trigger and a way to get at them so that they can actually be used to defray the cost of the benefits to the injured workers whose employers, workers' comp, liability insurance, insurer has unfortunately, hopefully not, but has unfortunately gone insolvent.
Okay. Does everyone understand that, Representative Ledoux?
Yes, I understand it. And I want to briefly, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair, go back to Section 22 and then ask a question about that in conjunction with Section 2.
Okay.
Section 22, as I recall, sets up a totally different workers' compensation benefits guarantee fund for those workers who are totally, whose employers are totally not insured. And so we discussed that at length on Friday. I was just wondering whether it might make some sense to, instead of establishing a new guarantee fund, to stick the money that you're going to get from the fines to the uninsured workers that you catch into the, what's the name of the other fund, the AGI?
Oh, the Alaska Insurance Guarantee Association that exists now?
The Alaska Insurance Guarantee Association, which exists now. Then you wouldn't have to set up another fund. You'd avoid the question of what happens if there wasn't enough in the fund. And I'm just wondering, how many people are hurt and their employers are uninsured? I mean, what kind of money are we talking about there? Would it make sense to just combine the two?
And just so for the record, Paul, we have Linda Hall online if there's any questions from the Division of Insurance, and Doug Willever if there's any questions from court system.
Okay.
And for their knowledge, we're going to end in about 25 minutes, so you'll be only be online until 4:45. Go ahead.
Okay. And trying to answer your last question first, I don't have a firm number that I can give you right at this meeting that would attempt to quantify what would have been paid out, say, this year, for example, if we had a guarantee, a benefits guarantee fund. I know that we, I believe, in the latest year that I had numbers for, there were about 25 injuries that involved people whose employers were not properly insured. And the part that I don't know, Representative, is, you know, the severity of those injuries and what a reasonable reserve might have been to pay all the expected benefits to those people. And I can try and bring something back to the committee in writing, see if there's any way we can do that. The first part of your question about whether they could be put together in the same fund, I guess I would maybe defer to Director Hall on that. I'm not really an expert in how the Guarantee Association functions currently.
Linda, did you hear the question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I did. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the concern I would have, one is the purpose of the guarantee fund, this particular fund, is the ability to protect claimants and policyholders from an insolvency of an insurer. In the legislation that was passed last year, we allowed, when that fund ran short, as it did last year, to assess not only workers' compensation insurers, but also all other property casualty insurers, so to speak. The cost for that is passed back to policyholders. We have a situation today where workers' compensation policyholders are paying a 4% surcharge to make up for the insolvent insurer's claims, and to add a whole nother burden to Alaska policyholders could create some inequities, so to speak.
Does that answer your question?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, Representative Roper.
I think it's important that Representative Ledoux, I think she understood the guaranteed fund better, might understand why I would say probably strongly in a negative, where you couldn't combine this newer fund with the insurance guarantee fund, because it covers not just workers' comp, but all property and casualty policies in the entire state. And I think we made a significant policy, we the legislature made a significant policy change last year by using that fund to entirely finance the stopgap requirements for this insolvency of the Fremont situation, which perhaps Ms. Hall, if you could explain to the committee the perceived liability and expectation was $60 million as a result of that insolvency, and then we've had to have, is the term assessments or draw on the fund, and could you explain very briefly the actual financial implications that have occurred to that fund as a result of the Fremont situation?
Through the chair, Representative Roepberg, I would be happy to do that. The situation last year, we had four insolvent workers' compensation insurers. The largest of those was Fremont, and who at the time of their insolvency in July of 2003 had approximately $60 million in outstanding claim reserves. We have three other insolvent workers' compensation insurers whose claims are also combined with those, and the assessment is made annually to insurance companies to put funds into the Guarantee Association to ensure that claims are paid. And the assessments can be made on all lines of coverage, but those assessments are also able to be passed back to policyholders. So in extreme situations, we could have a personal auto policy assessed for a workers' compensation claim or whatever it might be. And that is the concern that I have. If we combine the money, so to speak, we're almost guaranteeing that coverage for injured workers from employers who don't buy insurance is going to be covered through this guarantee fund passed back to additional employers automatically. And I think that could be another reason employers might think they don't need to buy coverage because their workers are going to be covered someplace else.
Right, and the guarantee fund just guarantees against insolvent companies.
Correct, insurance companies.
Which is a public policy determination and financed by these assessments. So the director's correct there. If we had otherwise, then it would be a disincentive to insure. Then you'd have socialized state insurance, then, is what you'd end up with.
Representative Ledoux?
I'm not sure that would be the case if you're going to be fining somebody who's not insured. If you are going to be fining them there, and are there criminal penalties for failing to have workers?
Well, it's going to be judgment-proof, most of them.
Failing to have workers' compensation?
Director? Hall?
That's Paul's piece of the question.
Director?
Sankey? Yes. It can be a criminal offense as well.
Okay, are you willing to go on to Section 3, or should we revert back to Section 21?
Well, I've got my answer. It may not be the one I want, but...
And I was kidding. It'd be nice to get past one section.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Roepberg.
Mr. Johnny, I understand this. Haven't had a chance to review it in total. It looks as if, Stanky, you said there currently is a 4% assessment. How are we going to...
What are you referring to, just so we know?
Section 2 here we're looking at.
Okay. Page 3.
We're putting up... Not sure how this is actually going to work. Are we going to segregate their reserves and require them to deposit a certain amount here in the state? Or can we do that under the Commerce Clause and various other things? How can we do this?
Linda, can you answer that, please?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Roteberg, several states now do require additional deposits for workers' compensation. And I felt to some extent last year when we did not have this deposit for the use of Alaskan policyholders, we were somewhat disadvantaged. For example, California has this type of deposit, which is based on loss reserves. It's also intended to protect against the insurer's piece of the assigned risk pool. If assigned risk pool, loss reserves would also be collateralized. As I said, several states do that. This bill has been through the Department of Law, so I am not aware of any legal prohibitions.
Mr. Chairman, could you explain the impact again on the high-risk pool, which is a major concern in Alaska?
The high-risk pool, when the premiums collected for the assigned risk pool are less than the claims paid out, that difference is a direct assessment on insurance companies. That assessment is not given back to the policyholder, but is a direct offset to the profits of an insurance company. When an insurer such as Fremont, who had a large market share, became insolvent, their share of those losses was reallocated out among the insurance companies who were remaining in our marketplace. So in addition to having, I think, you know, you recall me saying last year, Alaska has 5 out of the last 6 years had the highest assigned risk burden given back to insurers. That added even more to that burden, making our market even less attractive to insurance companies because of that reallocation.
Does that answer your question, Representative Roper?
In part, but we should move on, Mr.
Okay,
Chairman.
Thanks. Good. Section 3.
Section 3, Director Lysanky pointed out, merely gives a director of the Division of Insurance authority to take the deposits made under Section 2 and pay those deposits to the extent that there are claims to the guarantee fund, and then any balance would be returned to the liquidator, which is typically the chief regulator in the state where the solvent insurer is domiciled.
Any questions? Okay, seeing none, then we'll go to the next, the Department of Labor and Workforce Development's analysis here, page 2 of its analysis, which falls after page 4 of the bill, because remember, this is an order. I want to make sure everybody's there, and it's section 42. If you have that, go ahead, Paul.
This is the second of the 6 major areas, and these are changes that are designed for a quicker and more efficient resolution of disputed benefits claims. Section 42 is a change which would specifically legalize private attorneys to receive a one-time consultation fee of up to $300 to advise an injured worker about a benefits matter. This is something that actually refers back to some questioning from at our last committee meeting. Currently, it's illegal for anyone to accept an attorney's fee for a workers' compensation matter for representing someone or for advising them unless the Workers' Compensation Board approves the payment first. And we had heard for many years, long before I got to my present position, that was really stifling any opportunity for people to get a basic consultation and some advice that they might be willing to pay for, but the recipient was unwilling to accept because they didn't want to potentially be breaking the law. What happened was a number of years ago, the Workers' Compensation Board, by regulation, proposed to allow these payments to be received permissibly. But there remained a question about whether the regulation was sufficient, whether someone could rely on the regulation or whether the statute might still chill them doing that. So this is to specifically allow by statute what is being done by many people now under cover of the board's regulation. But there are some people that still refuse to do it because they're not convinced that the statute's not something to worry about, notwithstanding the regulation.
Okay, are there any questions? Representative Roper?
Yeah, the source of funds is the actual claim that's paid then? Is that the $300 is where the money's coming from?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Roperg. Initially, the source of funds would be the pocket of the injured worker that's actually getting the advice. And the way it's written is if the attorney takes them on as a client, then they will go forward on a contingency basis like most attorneys do, and they will be paid when they succeed. This is only to give a one-time opportunity for someone to pay out of pocket someone who is ultimately unwilling to take on their claim for whatever reason, but they're still willing to at least give them some advice up front.
I'm not sure I understand that then. I mean, they can do that already, but is it cap? Is that what we're doing here? Rather than $300?
No,
these plaintiff attorneys require more, or I don't understand why they can't. Anybody can't hire them. There's no recapture of the...
Through the chair, Representative Roekberg, the statute right now says that no one can pay a fee unless it's approved by the board in advance. This would cut that out.
So we're just getting rid of the approval.
Correct.
And we're mirroring more or less what would be common sense or common practice now.
Essentially.
Albeit we're putting a cap on it.
Haven't all sections been drafted with common sense in mind?
I'm glad you asked me that.
Mr. Chairman, I noticed that some of our colleagues from the other side of the aisle are not at the table to get their perspective on some of these sections. I'm kind of disappointed now.
I'm disappointed. They apparently chose to have a minority caucus at 4, so the committee goes till 5. Okay, any other questions? Seeing none, then we'll go next to Section 9, and there's two parts of that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Section 9 does have two parts. In the first part, Section 9 would allow the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to contract with a nonprofit organization in order to seek to provide information and legal assistance to injured workers who are unable to obtain private counsel. This is something that was suggested to us as an attempt to kind of address a very real problem that we see. Many people who are injured are able to get through the system with no assistance of counsel. I mean, by far the vast majority of them are. When things get disputed, many people prefer and think that they are doing better to have counsel to represent them, and in many really serious disputes, that's true. There are some people that continue to come to the board and say, I would really like to get an attorney, but I've approached the small number of people who represent themselves as willing and able to represent injured workers, and they have told me for whatever reason that they can't take my file. You know, and we hear from people that say that they've canvassed everyone that they know of, and they've all said for whatever reason no. So many times when someone does things on their own, if we call it legally pro se or whatever, as you know, they have a very difficult time dealing with the system, and the system oftentimes has a tendency to bog down in those kind of cases. What was suggested to us as a possibility was if we could try and provide some seed money to get some representation from a nonprofit organization to see if that improves the situation any. So that is the way that it's put in the bill, that it would give the department discretion to seek such a contract to be done on a limited contractual basis to see if it works out, with the idea that if there is a nonprofit that's willing to take this on, and if they do actually do legal work for people and they succeed, then they would be able to get attorney's fees awarded to them that would keep them doing it And this would be kind of a priming the pump.
Okay. For the record, so folks know, listening to the tape or the hearing, we have Representative Lynn present, Representative Cott, Representative Ledoux, Representative Roper, myself, Chairman Anderson, again, Representative Crawford, and Guttenberg left about 15 minutes ago to a minority caucus, and we're going through the second part of the six-part analysis for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development of the Governor's Workers' Compensation Bill. Representative Roper.
Is there a fiscal, what is your fiscal note or line item on this cost? And then would you assume it would have to be a legal firm, or could it be a nonprofit organization?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, the fiscal note associated with it for the first 2 years is, I think, $75,000 for the fraction of the first year and $50,000 for the fraction of the second year. A nonprofit organization would have to have an attorney to actually represent people. This is designed to try and get people attorney's assistance that they can't get anyplace else. They can get non-attorney assistance to some degree from the division. And there are some people that hold themselves out as non-attorney representatives who, there are a few. But this would clearly anticipate that if someone is going to sign legal paperwork for people and actually represent them, that they would have to be a licensed attorney.
That makes sense.
Okay. Why don't we go next? I think Section 9, self-explanatory, that it coincides with Section, the first part of Section 9. So how about Section 11?
Okay. Section 11 would allow injured workers who are represented by attorneys who are licensed in Alaska to settle their claims without having review by the Workers' Compensation Board. And by doing this, we would allow the board to continue to focus on its review on settlements of workers who are unrepresented by counsel, who are minors or incompetent, and people that we really would need to give some extra scrutiny to their settlements. Currently, every settlement has to be reviewed by the board before it's approved for any purpose. Otherwise, it's null and void. And this is an attempt to recognize that people who are able to get attorneys and are represented by a licensed attorney, when they finally do settle with their with the other parties to a claim, that they're able to just sign and resolve their disputes.
Any questions? Okay, we'll go next to Section 7.
Okay, Section 7 is something that formalizes what's already happening. You've heard a lot of testimony about the workers' compensation hearing officers, and last session there was testimony about where they might, you know, whether they should be part of a central panel or something else. But oddly enough, there was nothing in the statute that actually formally recognizes that we have hearing officers who are full-time state employees who it's developed over the years just as a course of conduct. As you know, the statute requires that the commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development is the chair of each individual hearing panel, and obviously it was just the volume over the years of hearings that developed that stopped the commissioner from doing that. And then for years they had someone who was just a designated representative of the commissioner, and I believe that's essentially where the language resides today. Nonetheless, a number of years ago, maybe 20 years ago, or more than 20, 25 years ago or so, the division started to use workers' compensation hearing officers, people who were attorneys, because of the complexity of, and the nature of the duties. And so what Section 7 would do is to formally require the use of hearing officers in lieu of the commissioner, and it would also require the board to adopt conflict of interest regulations, because there aren't any particular codes of conduct or ethics that apply specifically to board members.
Now, Paul, this was a bone of contention in the last session with the workers' compensation dialogue going on, and it was, I guess, acknowledged by labor unions that they felt that the hearing officer being designated by the commissioner led to perhaps a biased
How will the panel be comprised again? Just one more time, if you could reiterate that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the panels are still comprised the same way they are now. They would be one lay member associated with a representative of labor background, one associated with a management background, and then the third person would be the hearing officer. So the bill doesn't change the constituency of those hearing panels. It's still as it is today. Okay. Under the Act. The only difference is it puts now in statutory language what's actually happening, which is that the third person, the chair, is a hearing officer.
Okay. Are there any other questions, Representative Ledoux?
Are there any general regulations regarding ethics, et cetera, with respect to board members?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I believe that board members are subject to the Executive Ethics Act to some degree, but we do not have, like many workers' compensation boards or commissions, many of them you'll see that they'll have some kind of a code of conduct or the like, and they'll may have it in a regulation, they may just have adopted it internally. This would just give the board an opportunity to develop its own standards.
Follow up.
Has there ever been a problem using the general ethics regulations?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, not that I know of. About the only two cases I've ever seen that ended up in decisions of the Supreme Court involved ex parte contacts, which I believe were more or less inadvertent, but those are the only two that I'm aware of.
Okay, Representative Cott?
Well, then, you're saying that in common practice, we now have a hearing officer in the Department of Labor, commissioners not part of that panel?
That's correct. Through the chair, that's correct, Representative Cott.
And then why do we keep the same language in there that we've got each panel must include the commissioner or a hearing officer? If we're not using the commissioner,
that's a good question. Through the chair, I guess that's a reasonable question. I think we're just trying to be historical. I don't know. I suppose there might be a situation where the commissioner wanted to have the opportunity to chair a hearing panel, and we didn't necessarily want to preclude that. But it is true that it hasn't happened in recent memory.
So in practice, Mr. Chairman, then the governor is basically, or the administration, whoever it might be, the governor is appointing all three. The appointments are made. He's appointing the commissioner, he's appointing the labor rep, he's appointing the management rep, and if the commissioner of labor decides that he don't want to sit there, which in this bill looks like he has the option, then he appoints the hearing officer.
Through the chair, Representative Cott, the way it's been is that hearing officers, we have a number of full-time positions which are denoted as workers' compensation hearing officers, and we hire them to do that job based on their experience and their knowledge and their expertise.
Are these under contract, or are they within the administration?
Oh, I'm through the chair. No, they are full-time state employees. By and large, we do on occasion use contractors for a variety of reasons that you might, you know, anticipate. Sometimes if it's a conflict scenario that we want to avoid, sometimes if we're in a pinch because we have fewer people on staff than we would prefer, things like that. But by and large, these positions are anticipated to remain in the budget as full-time state employees.
Representative Ledoux, Lynn Rokeberg.
I was just going to ask whether or not these hearing officers, whether they're exempt employees or?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, right now, I think by historical accident, the current hearing officers are, I believe, in the general government unit, and they are represented employees. As the chairman alluded to earlier, there was some conversations last session about whether there might be some changes in that status. This bill does not get into those waters at all.
You're still a classified employee.
There wouldn't be any change in this bill as to what they are. So I presume, unless something...
Okay, good. Real quick, Representative Roberg, I want to see if we can't get to page 3 and get through...
Gentle lady from Kodiak asked my question.
Okay, good. We'll go to page 3 of the 6-page analysis, and page 3 begins with section 32.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Third major group is seeking to provide fair benefits at reasonable employer cost, which is something that the legislature has been attempting to do for many years. Section 32 is something that we discussed last session and is back, and it didn't get a lot of negative review at that time. It would propose to cap non-resident compensation rates at those that are paid to Alaskan residents.
So give a hypothetical, someone from Kansas, let's say, comes and they have a higher rate. Is that how?
It has to do with the cost of living where they're living, where they're residing. So if someone from Kansas was coming up and working here, got injured in Alaska, and started receiving their checks back home, or if somebody was a resident up here, got hurt, and moved to Kansas, what we have to do right now, the division has to do right now, is we have to hire a contractor to examine the cost of living in the place where the injured workers go after they leave Alaska. And if the cost of living is higher than the blended cost of living for Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, then they actually get a cost of living increment that is not paid to anybody outside Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Juneau within our own state. And as the committee is well aware, there are plenty of places in this state that have a higher cost of living than Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks blended together. So what this would propose to do is simply say, if you're outside, if you either move outside or you're living outside when you get hurt up here, we're not going to pay you a higher compensation rate than we would pay you if you lived here.
Okay. Representative Ledoux.
Are there any places in the United States that actually would have a higher cost of living than Alaska?
Through the chair, yes, very much. There are any number of them. We do this study... We've been doing this study every year, and there's always a good solid handful, especially places, as you can imagine, in California, New York, places like that, that have a higher cost of living.
Okay, Representative Ledoux, then Roper.
Just one more question, and this, what about if somebody moves out of the country? So if you're going to live, like, let's say, in a third world country, the general cost of living there might be quite low, but if you're going to live an American lifestyle in one of those gated communities within a third world country, it might actually be no less than it is here. How would you figure that out?
And you know her next question is, what if you're on the space station?
No, my constituents go to the Philippines, not the space
right.
station.
Representative Ledoux through the chair. Unfortunately, I know the answer to that question. We actually pay this contracting company when we know that someone's going to the Philippines. We pay them to do a cost of living in the Philippines for, I think it's Manila, but I think it's a large city. And it is postulated around kind of an American lifestyle. I mean, this is the market basket that they construct to determine what the cost of living is. And it's not third world. It's and not that I'm saying that the Philippines are third world, but you know, if you went to a third world place, it's an American package, if you will. And I do know for a fact that we've had to do cost of living for the Philippines, and I'm pretty sure we do it pretty routinely for Mexico as well.
Representative Roper,
thank you,
Chairman. I just wanted to editorialize, or not editorialize, make a comment on the. A few weeks ago, I was in Washington, the senior senator's office, who indicated the GAO is doing another review on the cost of living allowance for federal workers in Alaska, and he expressed his belief that the possibility that was going to continue was very remote because of the changing dynamic of cost of living between Alaska and some areas, a number of areas in the South 48 are actually becoming more expensive. Might be good. Interesting to note that.
It is. No, that is, actually. Why don't we go section 36 and then we'll quit. We have 25 more sections to go in the next meeting and then we'll be done going through this bill. So section 36.
Section 36 calls for the coordination of benefits payments between workers' compensation benefits and disability benefits that are paid under a disability plan to which an employer has also contributed. And the goal of this section is so that an injured worker does not get more in combined benefits from workers' compensation and from employer-provided disability benefits than they would take home in pay had they not been injured. This is not something I had made a misstatement at another committee, which I had to immediately underscore. I had erroneously referred to this as something that would offset a private disability benefit. And this is tied only to disability benefits that your employer also contributes to. And it's not really, it wouldn't really be, it's a kind of a moot point, I guess, for private disability things, because my understanding is if you or I try to purchase a private disability insurance policy, the first thing they do is start telling us how many things they're going to offset if we have more than one, if we get disabled and we have more than one source of funds. And the second thing they're going to do is make sure that they don't have any liability for more than about 70% of your pay. They're just not interested in going above a certain fraction of your pay. There are other circumstances of employer-provided benefits where, in addition to the workers' compensation benefits, certain employees get more than their take-home pay. That's what this is designed to address.
Any questions? Seeing, hearing none, then we'll hold off.
Mr. Chairman, you ready for a motion?
To move the bill?
I move we adjourn.
I wouldn't accept your motion. Okay, so we have gone through one-third of the workers' compensation bill, and Paul will come back. I appreciate your courtesy. You've been very thorough, and I don't know how much more thorough we can get than what you've done. I hope members are, like you've tagged that one issue, I hope you're tagging different areas that you'll want to look at amendments. And we will go through, in the next meeting, I hope to go through a couple more bills. Alaska Small Loans Act will also be considered, and then probably in an hour, I think we can get through. I'll make sure we keep it quick and then finish the analysis of the bill. Representative Roper?
Well, I got some bills coming up here. Surely, Mr. Chairman, yeah, but Mr. Chairman,
suddenly he's from the South.
I understand that there's some negotiations ongoing or some... There's been some potential modifications made to the bill we have before us. Is there any way, if that's indeed correct, is there any way we can get some kind of an outline or at least what those might be so we don't necessarily like go through this and just look at what's in this bill? I mean, what any suggestions you have there?
Because as we, Mr. Chairman Anderson, for the record, because as we go through the other two-thirds of this, if you were to come back and say, I realize you're restrained because you have to wait for their analysis and negotiations, but if the chief and the commissioners come back having worked out a plan with the ad hoc committee, then a lot of this may be for naught if they totally tweak the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I would say it's something that the governor would recommend to the committee.
Sure. So will you keep us abreast if there's any changes or anything of yes. substance that's been changed? Otherwise, we'll assume that there hasn't been any agreements
made.
It might save
us some time,
we'll
Mr. Chairman,
Yeah. No, that's good. I think Paul understands that. And if nothing occurs, then at the next meeting, we'll keep going through the bill that the governor has proposed. Thank you. Then we will adjourn at 4:53.